With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Slate's XX GabFest is brought to you by Squarespace. The new Squarespace 7 platform has a redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, new templates, and more. Get 10% off when you go to squarespace.com and enter offer code XX. Squarespace. Start here. Go anywhere. And by Fracture, the company that prints photos directly onto glass. Preserve memories with a unique gift that's a bit like hanging an iPad on your wall. Fractures are ready to mount right out of the package. Go to fracture.me to upload your photo and get 15% off your order with the code XX. That's fracture.me and use the code XX. And by HBO and the new documentary series The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. 4 decades, 3 murders, and 1 very rich man who refused to speak until now. The Jinx airs Sundays at 8, only on HBO.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, February 19th, the Honor Your Socks edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer at Slate. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine.
Hi, Hannah.
June, the Great British Baking Show. You have converted 3 generations of our family.
It's wow.
Like a warm bath. I love that show so much.
I know. And it makes me, A, so very hungry, and B, almost makes me want to start baking. And I'm just going to start with advanced doughs. Like, I'm not going to necessarily start with pies or anything basic. Advanced doughs. I want to proof that thing.
We use proof as a verb in our house now to mean everything.
What is proof?
Well, sometimes you've got to, yeah, exactly. You know, if you want to get a good bake, some things you've got to proof them.
I don't even know what it means. I think it means rise in
English.
Yeah,
it's like you have to do with bread. Oh. What is the verb for that?
You in America baking, you only proof yeast. It's like just to make sure that the yeast works. You don't proof anything else.
I think most of the things that are proofed do have yeast in them.
Right, but you would just say like a rise or
rise.
Anyway, it's confusing. They use proof for so many different contexts that I've never heard it.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Maybe this is just my obsessive egomania, but Sue Perkins, like, she's the British me, right?
Totally.
Because I would have like that job if I'd stayed in Britain.
Or I was afraid to say that, June, but she is totally you.
Or I'd be working in a W.H. Smith, but still, one or the other. I'd be either a TV star or working in a stationery store.
It's not too late, honey. You can still do it. Anyway, so our 3 topics for today. First, tidy your closets, change your life. The latest recipe for happiness from a Japanese decluttering guru, Marie Kondo. Second, a new generation of professional Hillary haters gets ready for the 2016 campaign. And finally, is dressing in drag just like putting on blackface? Ms. Cracker, a New York drag queen and writer, joins us to discuss the latest gender politics of her trade. Before we go to our first topic, decluttering, we want to hear from our sponsor, Squarespace, our loyal sponsor. My son and I have been working on a gaming site together because I'm like a really great gamer. No, I'm just a game mom. And so I try to learn about gaming. But the one thing I can help him with is setting up the website because the interface is so easy. You have access to Getty Images, which Squarespace has a partnership with. They have a new feature called Cover Pages, which makes it all very intuitive. And we, that is my son and I, can figure out all the features in very little time, which means you can too. And it looks really great on my phone, on any device. They have a 24/7 support line, live chat and email, and it's only $8 a month. So start a free trial with no credit card and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, use the offer code XX, that's spelled out DOUBLEX, to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for our show. That's XX, DOUBLEX. So let's move on to our first topic, decluttering. Marie Kondo is a celebrity in Japan and becoming one in America. Her new book, translated into English, is The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, preaches that when you put your house in order, you put your affairs and your past in order, too. It's weirdly simple, involves advice on how to fold your socks and organize your books. Her fans call themselves converts, with a K, and trade stories on what they've condoed, with a K, that day. The fridge, the attic, a pair of shoes. So we here on the XX Gabfest attempted a little bit of condomatic jujitsu on our own lives, and here's what it resulted in. Did you guys throw anything away? Like, have you guys managed to be, you know, converts in any significant way?
Well, we should first say what the condo method is, roughly. The key thing is you're supposed to touch everything in your house and see if it gives you joy. And the physical act of touching is different than just looking at it and thinking about whether it gives you joy. And if it doesn't, you toss it.
Does it spark joy?
Spark
is that
joy.
The word?
Spark joy. Sorry.
Do you know, weirdly, that's the word Jeb Bush used when he decided whether he was going to run or not. He said, I will run if it sparks joy. It
oh, my God. Maybe
like
he's into Marie Kondo.
Totally. He might be a convert.
But yeah. She has a whole order that you're supposed to do it in. Mm-hmm. There are some categories like clothes, books. What's her word for?
Kimono.
Kimono, which is like the et cetera in your life. And you have to do it in this exact order, which I did not do. But so I sort of half condoed my life.
You calmed.
I condoed my clothes and my books,
wow,
which are probably the most clutter in my life because I live in a pretty small New York City apartment. So I've had to do some more pragmatic throwing away before. But I felt really good. I felt really great. And then I lost steam.
What did the touching do for you?
The touching, honestly, for me, it was more like I just had to, if you got it out of where it was living before, if you took it out of the closet or off the bookshelves, you had to actually evaluate it. I think the touching is bullshit. I mean, I think a lot of what she says is bullshit. We should say up front that she's a pretty bad writer.
Terrible.
It's like a ridiculous premise. She talks about the feelings of your socks, how they feel bad being all balled up. And
I disagree with that. Actually.
Oh, go.
You think she's a good writer?
No, no, she's fine. I mean, who's a good self-help writer? Like, they're all kind of the same. Like, they tell you stories.
No, I'm so glad that Noreen sent us the article about her that had appeared in New York Magazine, because that made me feel like she was not an evil, like, force in the world.
She was evil?
The book is horrible. The book is not. It's not just because it's not very well written. That's fine. You know, that's not a crime. But it is, first of all, it's an article masquerading as a book.
Crime number one.
Throughout the book, there are sentences in bold. There are about, I don't know, 50 sentences in bold. You could just read those sentences and you would get everything that the book has to impart. I don't have any problems with the, you know, your thank your socks. That's fine. But she has, like, I'm not a therapist. I have no training in psychology, but I'm going to diagnose her problems. This woman has anorexia of things, and she is trying to make the rest of us have anorexia of things. She will not be happy until everybody's apartment is empty.
Not true. She says there is a level that makes everyone happy.
Yeah.
And you will know when you reach that level.
Yeah. She would come into my apartment and she would have a breakdown and she'd want me to throw out. She would say, a woman in her 50s, because that's how she describes everybody, threw out 25 bags of garbage.
Wait, June, are you a hoarder? Are you a hoarder?
No comment.
So, okay, I'm going to tell you why I don't hate this woman. First of all, now that you said that about the bowl, June, I've been looking. Can I just read you? Because it is pretty bad. You're
yes,
right. I'm just.
Yes.
But I guess in my head, I kept condescendingly thinking, well, this is just translated badly from the Japanese. So if you use the right method and concentrate your efforts on eliminating clutter thoroughly and completely within a short span of time, you'll see instant results that will empower you to keep your space in order ever after. Do you understand what that means?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Clean begets clean.
Okay, Midwestern 1950s over there.
Yeah, that's my terrain, okay?
All right, so I'm going to tell you a weird story about myself that happened just before I read this book and why it sort of struck me in some way. So I'm a declutterer. Like, I just get irritated and I throw lots of shit away. I do it often. And then every once in a while, something like just snags in my heart that I threw away, and it starts to fucking haunt me. And this happened to me recently because I don't touch the objects. I don't give them the proper respect to the socks and the books before I threw them away. Mm-hmm. So it's actually David who did this. He just like threw away a bunch of books from the kids' rooms because that's the main clutter, as they just have zillions of, you know, books everywhere. And so he threw them away. And I became haunted by the children's books. Like they, like in my dreams, they were full of like love and emotion and everything that was my years as a mother. And note, like my youngest child is now six, right? So they're all getting slightly older. And I became nuts about it. And I would just talk about it all the time. I would wake up in the middle of the night pacing. It was genuinely weird. And then what I did was I noted that he had given them away to the library. So I started stalking the people on the local library committee.
Oh my God.
I was really freaking weird. And then they were having a library sale. And so I rode my bike down to the library cell like an hour before they opened and like banged down the door. And I was like, I need everybody get out of my way. It was the weirdest I have ever behaved in public.
Wow.
It was so weird. And then it turned out that the person running the library sale was the mother of my editor at The Atlantic. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to risk this here. Like either she's going to think I'm nuts or she's going to like take pity on me. Well, and she took pity on me,
well,
and she let me like comb through the books and get back all the books that were ours. And I got them back for no reason at all. No child of mine is ever going to read them again. And I sort of put them in a little package in the attic. And I thought, God, Marie Kondo would have saved me that whole embarrassing month of my life.
Because I don't think she would have. I think she would support you keeping them, wouldn't she? Because you
yes, but I'm saying I would have touched them.
Oh,
and I would have known which ones contained like emotional value and that the objects, it was a lesson to me. And like my little son is always saying, he and his brother are having this fight about this stuffed animal. Is it real? And like my literal minded son is like, no, it's not real, you moron. It's just a dumb stuffed animal. And the little one is always saying, it's real. Like it is it real? And he's asked me, is it real? I know what he means. Like it's his love object. So he sleeps with it every single night. And it is kind of real. You know, like it almost has an expression. Like sometimes, oh my God, I'm sounding like a nut.
You
please
are a little bit.
Stop me.
You know when you said that your editor's mother had two choices. Were you crazy, or was she going to take pity? Like that's not an or, that's an and.
Yeah.
And we're feeling the same way. You are crazy, but it's okay.
Okay,
right.
But one of the reasons I thought that I was particularly susceptible to the Kondo way of living, which makes it sound like I'm moving to Boca or whatever, but is that I don't have kids, and I also am no longer 22 and super duper broke. So if I throw out things that, you know, feel cheap to me now or used up, I can probably afford to replace them or whatever. But I think it is sort of a rich person's thing.
Definitely.
And it's a person without a lot of sort of family baggage. It's a lot easier to enact this if you are only trying to please yourself. So I, you know, got rid of some things that had been gifts that I never loved. But I'd been sticking in, you know, hat boxes, and every year when I clean, I would get, you know, take them out and kind of look at them and be like, oh, yeah, that was
a nice birthday.
I'm not going to say because maybe that person listens to the podcast. But I have a lot of sentimental objects in my life. And one of the things that Marie Kondo says is that the gift serves its value in the moment it is given. That is the point of it. And I kept a lot of nostalgic, sentimental things, but it allowed me, that was one big thing it like allowed me to do. But again, like I am just kind of a free floating atom by myself. I'm not part of this big, messy household full of other people.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do think that there is a lot to where you are right now. I mean, other times in my life, you know, because of things going on in my life, no doubt, have condoed before knowing who Kondo was.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is clearly a relationship between feeling that you can let go of stuff and where you are in life. Right now, I'm at a place where I want to hold on to my stuff because I don't have that feeling, which I do think is essential to her way of shedding everything, that you could always get another one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm at that point where I'm like, well, I'm not sure I could. I don't want to just, I've spent money on this. I don't want to get rid of it because what if I need it or something like it again? I don't want to spend, you know, I had more money before than I have now.
Well, you also,
that's how I feel.
You also probably accumulated things that you love. I turned 30 this year. And so I feel like I'm in this transitional, like there's all this cheap shit I bought in my 20s just because I needed it. And I did need it and it was great. But I don't love it. And I look at it and I don't love it. And it's taking up space. Like I threw out, I'm trying to think what I threw out. I threw out my, people who went to college in the early aughts will appreciate this. I threw out the hair straightener that I used to use to straighten my hair before going out in college. I hadn't used it since I graduated. And I'd just been lugging around because it was, it felt weird to throw out a piece of electronics. But it was sort of like throwing out a version of my past self. And it felt great.
Yeah.
And not having to hold on to that because... Yeah, I guess it's sort of sentimental to think about straightening my hair with my friends in my dorm, but not really. I have pictures of, you know, my friends from college. I didn't need that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I definitely think that it is. I mean, I've visited friends' apartments who obviously have problems getting rid of stuff. And I've been in friends' apartments where you there is literally nowhere to sit because every surface is covered. Like, it's clear what where things can lead if you don't kind of take things in hand because nobody has a big enough house to not throw anything away.
Mm-hmm.
But she's just a little bit extreme for me.
And I also love when I walk into someone's house and it has like a nostalgic, idiosyncratic, like Rodarte kind of vibe going on. I can't manage that myself. I tend towards the, you know, declutter, but I really appreciate it in other people. I think it makes the house a more kind of beautiful human place.
But presumably all those people only have objects. Well, I don't know. I think you can have the sort of overstuffed, lovely, sort of homey decor and have the condo method. She's more talking about getting rid of the junk, not the things that you love. And maybe you love some of your junk, but it's more like picking away the things that will let the other things shine. I don't think it necessarily, because I'm not a big, like, I'm not a minimalist. And the idea of just living in a black and white, you know, shiny parlor seems terrible to me. But I think it can fit. Oh, my God, I sound like such a... disciple, but I think it can fit any lifestyle. My cult leader is endlessly adaptable.
That was not an ad. That was just Marie speaking. Okay. Are we done with Marie Kondo?
I believe we are.
No, I've only gotten through half the decluttering. Just kidding. We can move on.
All right. Listeners, declutter your life. Declutter one closet and let us know how it goes. You can even post pictures of what you declutter on the Facebook page before you say your official goodbye to it. Let's move on to our second topic, the new generation of Hillary haters. But before we do, we'd like to thank our second sponsor, Fracture. Fracture is a company that prints photos directly onto glass, which has been described as being like hanging an iPad on the wall. Colors pop like you wouldn't believe, and it comes on a solid backing that you can mount right out of the package, and you have to stick the screw in the wall and hang it. Now, I did actually get a picture from Fracture for my mother, and it was awesome. They say they throw in a screw. I can't tell you if my mother used the screw because my dad is pretty handy, but it really, really, really did look cool. It was like a picture of all the grandchildren on a trip we'd once taken to Israel, and she has it up in the wall, and it's awesome. So you should get it as a gift for your whoever.
A picture of your kids?
Yes. My kids and their cousins you should get. We will offer it on the website. Oh, my God. Anyway, it's $15 for the small square size. They make great gifts. And you can get 15% off with the code XX. That's the letters XX. Just go to fracture.me. That's fracture.me to check it out online. 15% off with XX. Okay. Our second topic. Hillary haters. With the 2016 campaign comes a brand new generation of Hillary haters. In the old days, the hate was very personal, an ugly sibling rivalry between the boomers. Now it's highly professionalized. There's an organized network of opposition researchers and strategists who are coming up with just the right way to vilify Hillary without triggering accusations of sexism. So, guys, do you sigh when you think of the next, like, we have to go through Clintonia again? Like, here we go again with Clintonia, particular brands of Hillary hatred. Like, what feeling does that bring up inside you?
That isn't the response that I have. I mean, I do think it's a very weird thing about American politics right now is that we do seem to be in a dynastic period. But the thing that bugs me is knowing that we're going to have just this kind of sexist response again. Not that every bit of opposition to Hillary is sexist, but a lot of it is. And it's kind of dispiriting to me.
Well, you really think a lot of the Hillary opposition is about sexism and not just that she is a continuation of Bill Clinton, and that she's sort of the thing that was most persuasive and interesting to me, and maybe this is sexism, was that people were upset when they thought about Hillary as just another politician, just another backroom dealer. And Hannah, in your article, I can't remember if it was you or someone you were quoting, said that basically that upsets people to know that this woman in politics is not above the men in politics, that we have this expectation that women in politics are always like sort of compromisers and idealistic and whatever, like Elizabeth Warren's, and they're like pure Joan of Arc's, like saving our country. And Hillary isn't. She's been around. She's, you know, stabbed a lot of people in the back. She's been stabbed in the back. And we sort of can't deal with that for reasons of sexism. But I just, to me, that's the least attractive thing about Hillary.
I think it's very difficult to break down, you know, the different parts, the different aspects of anti-Hillaryism. But it is very clear to me that part of it is sexist. I mean, this is the most obvious thing in the world, but I have never had a conversation about a male politician's appearance. Even when they look weird, nobody talks about it. And
I have. Martin O'Malley, super hot. I've had that conversation a number of times.
What do you mean? We just had a Slate email chain that was like the hottest congressman. And like people went into such deep detail that it was clear to me they've been thinking about it like for months.
If it was about Hillary being hot, maybe that would be. But it's not. People don't criticize male politicians' appearance. There are some
Christie. People make fun of Chris Christie being fat all the time.
Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan? Again, that's a positive thing.
No, I mock Paul Ryan endlessly.
I'm telling you that people, I have strangers like on planes, in parties, not so much in New York, it's true, but will say like, doesn't she look terrible? And, you know, she doesn't. She looks like a 67-year-old woman.
She looks great,
exactly,
I think.
Exactly. And it makes me insane that people on planes who are not dumb, who are very knowledgeable, they go to this place of, God, but doesn't she look terrible? No, she doesn't. And also, why are you even bringing that up? Or the thing, Hannah, in your piece, you talked to Matthew Continetti, who started Free Beacon, and he had this quote that I had to make a note of. He talked about Hillary being like a high school teacher I really dislike who can do you harm, but you can still snigger about behind her back. First of all, so fucking disrespectful. Shut your face, you little pisher. But secondly... Like, so wait, we're comparing somebody who has done really a lot of great public service. I know there are lots of issues with the Clintons, believe me, I know. But this is a person who could have made a lot of money by doing other things, who has been in public service. And you are comparing her sniggeringly, disrespectfully to a teacher who you snigger about.
But
I'm sniggering about you, Matthew.
But June, people compare her husband to like, you know,
well, her husband's a rapist.
Lounge.
I mean, sure.
I can tell you've got an open mind when it comes to the Clintons. People compare her husband to like a lounge lizard. I mean, there are like unflattering comparisons made about politicians all the time, male and female. And
that's so funny because I read that. Go, oh, sorry, you finished.
Well, I think it's. Were you going to say you think it's ageist?
No. Go ahead.
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think the ageism with Hillary is actually more interesting and new, and the way that ties into the sexism. But I feel like to just like Hillary because people are sexist against her is itself a kind of sexism.
Oh, burn.
Does anybody like her for that reason?
I do. Yeah.
You do,
I think
June.
There's...
No, I don't.
I think, yeah. I think boomer women... I think there's a group of boomer women who feel... And this came up a lot in the 2008 campaign, I would say, who feel like Hillary got raked through the coals. She was a pioneer. She got the worst of it. And we owe it to her, you know? And, like, Barack Obama came out of nowhere... And he got to miss all of this because he came up at a time when America was a little bit more enlightened and she got the brunt of it. You know, and if you don't support Hillary against all this sexism, you are a traitor to the cause.
I mean, I haven't really seen that. I mean, I absolutely recognize the things that you're talking about and I do feel some of them. Like, and, you know, again, as Hannah's piece pointed out, there is a sweet spot that this very professionalized opposition research has to finesse of, you know, being very aggressive and, you know, doing what modern political campaigns are about and not stressing that sexist kind of approach because people will be offended and will sympathize with her. So that's definitely an issue. So there is, yes, I do sympathize with Hillary, but that's not why I like her to the extent that I like her. It is very difficult to break down all the little bits of it, though.
I think it's actually kind of okay, Noreen, if people still use Hillary as a template for women in power. Like, I do think she gets that one. You know, I quote this group called Burning Glass Consultants, which are these three sort of veterans of Republican campaigns, and they're doing a lot of work in trying to coach Republican candidates on basically how to, you know, talk about the age issue without triggering sexism, because they find that if you say Hillary's too old, as like Karl Rove had some whole riff about how Hillary was aged and decrepit and stuck in the hospital, you know, he was just making shit up. But like they found that women do, you know, raise their hackles and say like, well, nobody said Ronald Reagan was too old. Like, why is it that women have an expiration date when men don't have an expiration date? So I actually think that's a fair reason to support Hillary, just to kind of put that up in their faces. But then again, they're now finessing this so well so that there's all different ways to talk about Hillary's oldness without actually saying she's old. So like Marco Rubio said something like she's a 20th century candidate in a 21st century world or something like that. Like there's a way of saying her ideas are old or she's been around too long without saying, you know, she's old. What do you guys think of the Hillary plutocrat line? You know, this idea that, you know, they used to say she was a money grubber in Arkansas who, as I started my Atlantic piece with, you know, gave Bill's underwear to auction for a dollar each, took a tax break on his underwear. And now it's like, you know, she gets $300,000 a speech, you know, all the stuff about the contracts that she has with universities. So her water has to be a certain temperature and she has to have certain things in the green room, you know, all the green M&M stuff about Hillary. Do you guys find that distasteful?
I don't, in part because the Clintons may or may not have been on the take early in their career, but that was something born of wanting to have more money. And now I think they're like kind of in a Bloomberg place where I actually kind of don't hate when politicians are wealthy because I think it makes them less corruptible, which is a weird oligarchic thing for me to say. But not everyone is Michael Bloomberg, and he himself has his issues with being out of touch. But I think it's like it's just not a criticism that bothers me that much.
Right. She is a former first lady. I mean, that's as elitist as it gets. I mean, the fact that the Clintons are now rich should not be a surprise to anyone. I mean, the question is, are they corrupt? That's different from are they rich? I think this is, at this point, the biggest cliche about political campaigns. But nevertheless, your piece, Hannah, made me wonder why anybody would run for election. There are other ways to become rich these days. It's not about, and you could get much richer and with much less scrutiny if you weren't a politician. Why would anyone run for president knowing that there are going to be trackers at every public event that you do from now until the day you die? You know, there's just so the type of scrutiny and the, you know, just the fact that already there are 50 people in this one organization monitoring everything that Hillary Clinton does or says, that just thinks, why would you do this? What was the biggest shock to you as you were doing this research, Hannah?
Just the depths of the hatred, like the fact that people publish these best-selling books, which are just full of nonsense. And the nonsense is incredibly vicious and ill-sourced. You know, the idea that they were hanging crack pipes on the White House Christmas tree, or like that she was having lesbian sex in the White House basement shower. I mean, it's just crap, you know. And the thing about the crap is that it's like they're bestsellers, and that it does infuriate you. Yeah. You know, like, what is it about her or her and him that brings this out in people? You know, I did a comparison with Obama hatred, like a quick comparison. Obama hatred has a kind of, you know, otherness to it. He's other. He's a Muslim and he's from a mixed marriage and he's got this weird middle name. You know, people kind of, he's different from me. But the Hillary, the Clinton hatred has an intimacy which is just vicious. You know, it's like hating somebody in your own family. Now, maybe that's a thing of the past. Like, that's something that the boomers did and the millennials who run all these OPPA research groups, you know, that quote you said, June, about how he said she was a teacher. It's funny, when Matthew Continetti said that to me, it really clarified for me that they actually were in awe of the Clintons in some way. Like, they thought of the Clintons as untouchable in the same way that as a high school student you think of a teacher as untouchable. Like, you can throw darts at the teacher, but you can never really touch her, you know? So, to me, that quote really just clarified how the millennials saw Hillary so differently than how the boomers saw her.
Well, and Hannah, you had some really interesting bits where you quoted Peggy Noonan. And what's the name of the woman who...
Barbara Comstock.
Barbara Comstock. Women of her own generation who you said, and you quoted a Peggy Noonan column where she basically wrote this, that they see themselves in Hillary. And so it's like the betrayals in some way are harder. The fact that she went this certain way and they went this certain other after being like a, you know, dutiful high school student. But then they themselves had these careers where they encountered sexism. And now Barbara Comstock, who is this huge Hillary Abo researcher in the 90s, is a Sheryl Sandberg lean-in acolyte. And she's, you know, I don't know if she's discovered feminism or if she's just really enjoying this particular permutation of it. But I thought that was really striking.
Yeah, that was my favorite footnote in the piece, because I used to write about those Republican women when I worked at the New Republic back in the day. And there was a way in which they were just living this impossible contradiction. There was this wave of really ambitious women, Republican and very conservative women in politics in the 90s, but they were operating in a family values world. And so Barbara Comstock was known for working all night long, and she had three little kids. And it just must have been a really painful contradiction for a lot of these women. And now it just doesn't matter anymore. Like, those issues have just kind of faded, those culture war issues. You know, it's completely routine to have Republican, conservative women in politics, Sarah Palin with her kids in her arms or whatever. It's just not a big deal. So a lot of those issues have faded. And yes, she wears a like women. She has like a women rule iPhone case or whatever it was. As a reminder, the story we've been talking about is Among the Hillary Haters by me in this month's Atlantic. And you can find it on the Atlantic website now.
All right, before we go on to our final topic, we have a word from our final sponsor, which is HBO, who have a new show, The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. This is about a guy who has been accused of three murders. He's a very rich man, and the show about him airs on Sundays at 8 p.m. on HBO. I've watched the first two episodes, and they are fascinating.
Agree. I'm loving it.
Oh, my goodness.
Loving it.
And there's a law now that you have to mention serial in the context of every true crime story. But to me, more than a question of guilt or innocence, the thing that's so compelling is a close-up view of how weird it is to be rich in America, like to be really very, very rich. It does destroy your soul, or it can destroy your soul, I guess. And just seeing Robert Durst's affect is just fascinating. So the show exposes long-buried information discovered during the seven-year investigation of a series of unsolved crimes, and it was made with the cooperation of Durst, who has consistently maintained his innocence and remains a free man today. It comes from Andrew Jarecki and Mark Smerling, the Oscar nominees behind Capturing the Freedmans. And The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst, airs Sundays at 8, only on HBO.
So let's move on to our third segment, Drag Queens and Blackface. This segment begins unexpectedly with Mary Cheney, a Republican daughter of Dick and a lesbian, ends with Ms. Cracker, a writer and drag queen from Harlem, who's going to join us on the segment today. First, Mary Cheney. After seeing a commercial for RuPaul's Drag Race, she posted on her Facebook page, "If it's not socially acceptable for a white person to put on blackface for entertainment, then why is it socially acceptable for men to put on dresses, high heels, and makeup and act out every lame stereotype of women? Bitchy, catty, dumb, slutty." Now, we sometimes like to dismiss out of hand anything said by a member of the Cheney orbit, but this was an interesting question. And to help us answer it, we've invited on Ms. Cracker, a writer and drag queen from Harlem, who wrote about this for Slate this week. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
So let me ask you, when you first read Mary Cheney's thing, were you like, oh, that's lame, no way? Like, what was your initial first reaction to Mary Cheney's Facebook post?
My initial response was kind of split in two. Of course, as a drag queen, I wanted to defend drag and the art of drag and the drag community right away, and that was sort of a knee-jerk response. But there was also a part of me that thought that her comments rang true in some way, and I couldn't really articulate that at first. But in the days after I read the post, I started remembering the cisgendered women and biological women and women of all kinds who had expressed to me some concerns about drag as a misrepresentation of women or a way of degrading women.
You know, Ms. Cracker, I wonder if you could talk about the extent to which you see drag as being about imitating women. I mean, I grew up in England where there's this weird long tradition of drag being very mainstream on television all over the place. But it's often referred to as female impersonation, which does not seem to me to be what most drag is about. So can you talk about the extent to which drag is about pretending to be a woman or trying to pass as a woman?
I ne'er the twain shall meet, I usually say, because I think most drag queens are not interested in creating what we call a female illusion, or as we call it in the drag community, also serving fish. though, actually, I want to talk about that phrase a little bit later.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I wrote an article for Slate about the diversity within the drag community as far as the reasons that people do drag and how drag looks and what it's for, because every drag queen has their own reason. Some drag queens don't even bother trying to shave their face. They don't try to give you a feminine look at all. They have mustaches and they show their hard masculine bodies. They'll wear a sports bra over big pecs. You know, there's such a diversity, as I said, that I don't know. I think female impersonation has a separate name because it is a totally separate mm-hmm. thing. And drag is a whole separate aesthetic that, yes, alludes to and toys with femininity and womanhood, but doesn't live there.
See, the strain I'm always tuned into is, like, is there hostility or is there not hostility? You know, there's like making fun with love. There's like making fun with indifference, and there's making fun with hostility. You know, like I was thinking of Kate McKinnon's Justin Bieber imitation, and like, what's the spirit of that imitation? Because that's another form of drag, right? She's gay.
Right.
She's impersonating a man or dressing like a man or trying to look like Justin Bieber. And you wrote about strains of hostility, basically, that are in the drag community, I think, when you were trying to grapple with what Mary Cheney said.
I don't want to land on the idea that the drag community or all drag queens have malicious intent towards women. I don't think there's a consciously hateful feeling towards women in the drag community. I do, however, recognize that I live in a homosexual community and I live in a homosocial society. So I think it's very easy, if a drag queen is not being conscious, for negative ideas about women to sort of into their work, because it's something that has to be guarded against actively in order for it not to happen. I think that's sort of what's happening.
I guess it had never even occurred to me to be offended by drag. I'm not sure why. Maybe because, you know, I think a really great send-up of Dolly Parton is delightful, and I don't recognize myself in that in any way. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about Mary Cheney's comparison to blackface, which I found pretty bombastic, and maybe partly because I hadn't fully thought this through and thought to be offended, or maybe I just haven't experienced enough drag to understand it fully enough to be offended. But I wonder if you could talk about whether you think that comparison holds up, and if it holds up partway or all the way.
Well, I'm not an expert on the history of blackface, but I did, in my article, discuss this a little bit, my article for Outward, which is the queer section of Slate, and I think ultimately my decision is that it's a ridiculous comparison if you're going to take it at face value. Drag's influence now, even as in its sort of golden age with RuPaul's Drag Race, has nowhere near the amount of influence that minstrelsy and blackface had at its height in America. It was an art form that was pervasive throughout America and that we exported throughout the world. And as a consequence, people throughout the world were learning about people of color and African Americans exclusively from blackface, having had no encounter in some communities with people of color, with African Americans. So I think the damage that blackface did, on the scale that it did that damage, makes it like so different in its scale than drag, and different in its intention. I think that comparison really cannot be made. So instead of taking it at face value, I just had to take the emotional content behind the post. And I think what she was trying to do is say, is drag the worst ever? Which is essentially what you're saying when you compare something to blackface.
Right.
It's like comparing someone to Hitler. It's like comparing an event to the Holocaust. Like, obviously, you're using those trigger words to get a rise out of the listener when all you're really saying is this the worst? And I think that's what she was asking.
Do you think Mary Cheney has ever seen a drag show?
I bet she has.
I mean, she was watching, at the time that she posted that post, she was watching a commercial for the upcoming season of RuPaul's Drag Race. So, I mean, that suggests to me that she has access and she is on the right channel to see drag queens in some form. I don't know if she's seen a show.
I have to say that especially, I mean, Mary Cheney lives in D.C., I lived in D.C. many years ago, but some of the drag shows that I saw there were the most, like, they made me question myself and life in like, really significant ways that other drag shows haven't. I mean, drag is often, like, to me, the times when I feel, okay, we queer people are different, we have a community, we're not all the same, we're quite diverse, that feeling comes across strongest as a drag show. There's something very visceral, very emotional about drag. And it's not just that whole kind of performing gender and really, you know, making us realize how ridiculous gender expectations are. There's something very kind of destabilizing about it. And I remember like going to drag shows in DC where there would be essentially a lot, it was a lesbian audience, mostly butch lesbians, with not the prettiest drag queens, not the slenderest drag queens, not the most convincing drag queens, and essentially lining up to put dollar bills, you know, down their cleavage. And there's something so destabilizing and yet at the same time amazing and liberating and kind of community building about that. So I wonder if, you know, Mary has gone down to the Fays one Sunday afternoon and, you know, stuck some dollar bills down Ella Fitzgerald's cleavage. It wouldn't surprise me one bit.
So do you think that the conversation penetrates then? Like, do you think it's just ruinous of the drag queen spirit to kind of insert this, you know, these concerns and the feminism and the worries about people in the audience? Like, in some ways, you don't want to ruin that spirit of parody and fun, you know? Like, is there a way to have this conversation and preserve the fun?
Yeah, well, one of my biggest concerns as an artist and as a writer is chilling freedom of expression. And I love that word, chilling, because without fully blocking freedom of expression or creating rules against it, you can make it uncomfortable for people to express themselves and slow freedom of expression. So I was wondering, by bringing this up and by bringing an awareness to the drag community of women's issues and women's response to drag, is it chilling our freedom of expression? And I don't think it is. To look at what you're saying and carefully observing everything that you do to make sure that you're being loving and sensitive, I think that's an important activity. You don't want to censor yourself in any other way, but I think censor yourself as far as like spreading hateful ideas and hateful images, I think that's a worthwhile self-censorship. obviously, you don't want that to be external, but I think it's a conversation that every drag queen can have internally with themselves. It doesn't chill free expression. It applies a constraint, and I think constraints are very, very useful. Drag queens filter their creativity through constraints all the time, and you see how we flourish. So I don't think double-checking with ourselves to make sure we're not being hateful is going to curb our creativity. And I think for most queens, they're going to look at themselves and realize that yes, they're not doing anything hateful, so I don't think they're going to run into a problem.
Excellent. Well, let's end on that hopeful note. Thank you so much for joining us. That was delightful.
Thank you so much.
Bye, Missy. If you want to check out Ms. Cracker's piece, the title is Drag Isn't Like Blackface, But That Doesn't Mean It's Always Kind to Women. You can find that on Outward on Slate.
Okay, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
Well, my fake recommendation is 50 Shades of Grey, but I think it's a really unexpectedly funny movie. And I'm not sure I recommend spending $12 or whatever on it, but I recommend its place in the world as a sort of tongue-in-cheek send-up of the book itself. And also the soundtrack is legit pretty good.
You think it's a tongue-in-cheek send-up?
The movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think it's campy.
I think it's half campy. Like, my view really was that, like, she was in a campy movie that was a send-up, and he was in the book.
Straight man, funny man, you know?
Straight man, funny man.
It was tedious near the end. I got bored. But it's worth seeing. maybe wait for Netflix, maybe go to theaters. But my real recommendation is I've been reading The Sports Writer by Richard Ford, which is a really excellent book and not a super double X-y book. And that's partly why I'm recommending it, because it's not the kind of book that I would necessarily pick up. I'm not super into middle-aged male ennui. And so I think I have probably shut myself out of a lot of, you know, really wonderful books. Like I got put down, you know, the first of the Rabbit trilogy halfway through. I've never picked up Cheever in any real way.
Wow.
I know. And I decided to read The Sports Writer, and it's just such a fine piece of fiction. So my recommendation is to read outside your comfort zone.
Oh, I like that. I'm in the comfort zone. I'm recommending Self-Portraits with Men by Czech photographer Dita Pepe. I loved this photo essay. It was about her imagined with 100 different husbands. And so she just kind of seamlessly inserts herself into 100 different family situations. And it's like what life could be like if you were married in 100 different ways. It's really, really cool. It's online on a site called The Plaid Zebra, and we will put a link to it on our show page. My second recommendation is a British magazine that I used to love called World of Interiors. And the reason I'm recommending it this week is because it's kind of the opposite of Marie Kondo's spare aesthetic. It's very idiosyncratic and kind of old world and much less designed than like Elle Decor or your average modern design magazine. So I actually went on the World of Interiors website to reclutter my mind after reading Marie Kondo's book. June.
A very predictable recommendation for me, which is the show Marry Me, the sitcom. It's about a couple who are newly engaged, even though they've been together for 6 years. And the pilot was just terrible. It was just a bad pilot because you just really didn't get a sense of what the show was going to be about. Were they going to, like, was he going to propose to her every week? And they seemed unlikable. But it's really developed into the kind of show that I enjoy, which is just a bunch of weird friends hanging out and doing crazy things and just kind of being kind in strange ways to each other and being funny. And it has a very similar vibe to Happy Endings. It's made by one of the creators of Happy Endings and stars Casey Wilson, who was Penny on Happy Endings, along with Ken Marino. And there's a great lesbian character, and I just think it's very funny.
Sounds great. One note, if you get a chance, check out the documentary Hunting Ground, which comes out on February 27th. It's a fascinating documentary about sexual assault on campus, which we are going to talk about on our next show. Now, thank you to our producer, Ann Hepperman, to the managing producer of Slate Podcast, Joel Meyer, executive producer, Andy Bowers. You can go onto our show page to learn more about the show and the things we discussed, slate.com/XX. Or our Facebook page to leave comments, notes, things you want us to discuss, facebook.com/XXGabFest. And actually go to the damn Facebook page and like us. We could use more likes. Or email us at XXGabFest@slate.com, which many of you have been doing. Or subscribe on iTunes so more people find out about the show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in 2 weeks.
Hey, DJ, love the way I lose my inhibitions when you speak.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.